ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. The origin story of one of the world's most popular websites involves a very unwell newborn baby girl. She's fine now, but those first stressful days inspired the format of Wikipedia. Today, you'll hear that story and more as I speak with founder Jimmy Wales about a commodity he says is under threat. Trust. We'll talk about what running Wikipedia has taught him about building and keeping trust, along with how he navigates tricky work relationships and what AI means for our future. Also ahead, another internet story, as it turns out, how Australian Facebook users could nab a share of a $50 million privacy breach payout. But don't expect a huge windfall. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, pedophiles have infiltrated childcare. That's the headline from last night's Four Corners program.
They use encrypted sites using anonymising browsers such as the Tor, and that lets them hide online. And what we found was there's about 45,000 different pedophile forums on the dark web. Some of them have got over a million unique users. And what they do there is they trade information. And we got a Canadian Centre for Child Protection, which created a project called Arachnid that hunts child abuse material across the web. So we asked them to have a look on these forums for any chatter about childcare. And they came back with a lot of stuff. Most of it we were unable to use because it was just so graphic and explicit.
That's ABC journalist Adele Ferguson speaking on AM this morning. The details are appalling, and it's not the first time we've heard stories like this. So with summer just around the corner, some centres shutting down over the holidays, a lot of you are asking, where do you send your kids next year? How do you know they're safe? And more importantly, how would you even know if something was wrong? This morning, you are going to get a lesson in how to teach your children body safety. But first, Rachel Sharman is a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of the Sunshine Coast. Rachel, welcome back to Life Matters.
Good morning.
We've heard stories like this, especially over the course of this year, as Four Corners has been doing its investigations. Is there any trust left in the childcare system?
Look, it's really problematic, isn't it? And if we look at some of the context behind this, if we sort of just take a big picture step back, you know, we live in a society now where it's very difficult for two parents not to work. So for a lot of parents, childcare is an absolute necessity. And as was also pointed out in the Four Corners program, we have a childcare sector that is very much for profit. So really, you know, the profit, the dollars come before absolutely everything else. And, you know, those sort of two contextual factors, I think, drive a bit of a system that was ripe for these sorts of problems.
So, like you say, it feels like a non-negotiable for a lot of parents that having care for their children is something that they need. What tools do parents have at their disposal to figure out where it's going to be safest for their child?
Yeah, look, so there are a few things that parents can do. And first of all, I should point out, I guess I'm talking first of all about parents who are lucky enough to have a choice. I am very aware that some parents, you know, may only have one available childcare centre in their entire region. So, you know, again, that's another issue that that needs to be looked at. Where are we building these centres? Who's the regulatory authorities there? Mm. I know that has been brought up previously as well, where you have some areas that are bizarrely saturated with childcare centres and others that have hardly any. So, you know, who on earth is making these sorts of decisions? But if we assume that parents do have a choice, there certainly are a few things they can do. So the first thing is to look up the, it's got a very long name, so I'll just read it out, the Australian Children's Education and Care Quality Authority, a CEQA maybe, that's sort of short for something like that. They do actually have a national register where they list childcare centres where they feel that their standards aren't quite up to scratch at the moment. So, you know, as a, just a first broad brush port of call, you might not want to even consider a centre that the regulatory authority has already said, hey, you know, we're a bit worried about this one. So strike them off your list straight away. The second thing is to actually go and visit the childcare centres. Most centres are very good. They'll let you actually stay for half an hour, up to an hour with your child actually in the room that they will be in. And that gives you an opportunity to just have a look around and, you know, have a bit of a, I suppose, an analysis and judgment of what's going on here. So things to look out for that are positive are staff that are happy and smiling and interacting, you know, with each other, with the children, all that sort of stuff. There's also some logistical stuff that Four Corners sort of touched on but didn't go into. And it's how is the centre built? Like, are there areas that are quite sort of cut off and out of visibility? You can't really see what's going on. You know, some centres are really well designed where they have really good visual fields of absolutely everything, big outdoor area where the kids are all playing. These are all positive sorts of signs. So, you know, looking at the staff and how they're behaving and interacting, do they seem happy? You know, have they been there a long time? You can ask staff, you know, how long have you been working here? If they've been there for years, that's a good sign. If they're changing every 6 weeks, that's a bad sign. But also look at the layout of the centre. You know, does it sort of provide opportunities perhaps for children to be kind of sequestered away secretly, or would that actually be quite difficult given the layout of this particular centre? So, you know, really go in there with some open eyes and start making some judgment calls.
So like you say, there are regulatory authorities around here. There are rules here. I think what the Four Corners investigations have shown that there are loopholes that have been exploited. What sort of work needs to be done to close those loopholes?
Yeah, look, I think for me, I actually worked for the Children's Commission many years ago and, you know, part of that whole blue card system. And a couple of surprising things dropped out there. And this seems to happen every time we have a coronial inquiry or Four Corners decides to go and sniff around something, they always come up with information is not being shared. So I was quite stunned. I actually thought the sort of the different regulatory blue card people actually shared information with each other. There you go. Even I didn't know that. I used to work for them, for heaven's sakes. Apparently they don't. So perpetrators can, you know, hop states. And Queensland doesn't necessarily say to New South Wales, hey, you want to watch this bloke. You know, so there's some real problems there with reporting and regulation. And look, the other thing I should just mention, also very, very many years ago now, decades literally, I worked for Child Protection. And we would take reports from people. So let's say the neighbour rings up, right, and goes, oh, I'm a bit worried about the next door neighbour's kids, blah, blah, that might not meet the threshold for investigation. And it certainly might not meet the threshold for being substantiated. But there would always be a record. And if in a couple of years' time something really weird happened, we could literally pull out, I dare say, the old sort of manila folders and go, oh, there's been 9 reports about this person. How terribly interesting. Here you go, Mr. Police Officer. So I think there's a real problem here about just the lack of reporting. A lot of the parents were sort of saying, well, we made complaints and it just went nowhere. And it looks like it's been recorded nowhere. It seems to me some system of mandatory reporting and at least a repository of information where this is held would be enormously helpful, and that has to be Australia-wide and it has to be shared interstate.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking with Rachel Sharman, who's a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of the Sunshine Coast. But as she's been saying, her CV is extensive and has worked in child safety, talking about the really, really harrowing, worrying revelations out of Four Corners yesterday and today about pedophiles intentionally exploiting loopholes to be able to work in childcare and what we can do about it as a nation, but also as parents and carers, what agency we have to help equip our kids and to watch out for warning signs. Next, you're going to hear from the CEO of Body Safety Australia, Deanne Carson, who is the CEO of Body Safety Australia. It's an organisation that promotes childhoods free from violence, where children can enjoy equitable and respectful relationships. Deanne, listening to this reporting, seeing what's been revealed over the last couple of days, what's your visceral reaction to that?
Watching Four Corners last night, I think so many parents must have been so distressed, wondering about whether their children were safe and what they can do to actually safeguard their children in early childhood.
Yeah, on the text line, Emily's saying, it's nuts to me that parents need to assess their childcare centre for areas that provide opportunities for child sexual assault and abuse. It's a sign of a broken system. That's really it, isn't it?
Yeah, it has been increasing over the last few years, where we know that there are vulnerabilities in the system and predators know that there are vulnerabilities in the system. So they're targeting early childhood education in order to gain access to young children who perhaps don't have the capacity to say what, you know, is happening to them.
Yeah, I do want to acknowledge that talking about body safety is not a panacea for a system that should work, and that a lot of this reporting has focused on regulatory requirements. But I do feel like when we hear these things popping up, you can feel so disempowered and so afraid as a parent. And so I'd love it, Deanne, if you could sort of share a bit about what body safety is and how it can be part of a child's toolkit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the most important thing to say, Tegan, is that it's actually never a child's responsibility to protect themselves from any kind of grooming or abuse. It's always an adult. So when we talk about teaching body safety education, what we're actually talking about is teaching the child, obviously, but teaching and empowering all of the adults around the child. So empowering their educators and teachers, empowering their parents, their caregivers, their grandparents, to understand how they can better uphold the child's rights to bodily autonomy, to identify grooming, to step in if they are concerned about an adult's behaviour, and how to raise the alarm in a way that they can be heard. So I think that's the first thing that we have to talk about, that, you know, it's always the adult's job to step in those spaces, particularly when we're talking about very young children, babies, toddlers, and preschoolers as well. And so for the adults, what I'd say is the number one thing that you can do is, ask the centre director about their hiring and training practices. So actually put people on notice. So, you know, body safety is important to us. How do you do this? And that is true of whether they're going to early childhood education or to school or to a friend's house for a sleepover. How do you do this? You know, how do you do body safety? How do you actually address appropriate and inappropriate behaviours? And then the next thing I would say for the adults is to build strong relationships with the staff who are taking care of your children all day, every day. Understand, the relationship that the staff have with the children, what is important in that space. But also what we know about grooming and what we saw in Four Corners last night is that predators groom adults first. They groom the parents first. So if a staff member seems too good to be true, if they are perfect in every aspect, if they pay special attention to one or a couple of children, I would be really watchful in that space. I would start to ask questions. If they're offering to babysit, that's a blurring of their professional boundaries. So these are the sorts of flags that, as parents, you can watch out for.
What you said, talked about asking questions at the centre. What's the right answer for them? What answers are you would you be listening out for if you were asking those questions?
That's a great question. So I would be looking for a centre director who is really confident and comfortable answering those questions. So they might have the child safe standards or the national principles displayed around the centre, because those standards and principles came out of the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse. So they're standards that we know that can help keep children safe. They might be able to answer questions about, or when we are hiring and interviewing, we ask questions about, what does grooming look like? How would you intercept if you thought a colleague was harming or grooming a child? When did you last do any training on teaching body safety or on mandatory reporting? So if a centre director can answer those questions confidently and seems happy to answer them, then you feel more confident that you can enter into those conversations and that you're at a centre where they take that seriously.
On the text line, Marianne says, I'd not agree with teaching kids to protect themselves. This is not a child's responsibility. This is our responsibility individually and as a community. It's not a broken system. It's a broken society. And yeah, Marianne, I'm going to cop that. I think I've used some pretty clumsy wording before when I was introducing Deanne. And as you say, Deanne, it's the adult's responsibility around kids to keep them safe. But you are, in the work you do, talking to kids as well, giving them some tools. When is a kid old enough to start learning about body safety?
Yes, that's right. It's never a child's responsibility, but a child is never too young for us to let them know that they have rights, and they have rights not to be harmed. They have rights to seek help. And they have rights to make decisions about, you know, who touches their body. So we can do that from infancy when we're just talking to children about what is happening with their body. We can let them know what it feels like to feel safe inside their body. So from infancy, you can start having these conversations, knowing, of course, that it is still our responsibility, but we're letting them know their rights. And then as they get older, as they become verbal, we can enter into those lessons more explicitly. And we can use books and songs and games and just those incidental conversations. So, for example, it's really important to let a child know language, recognisable language for naming genitals. They need to be able to say what their genitals, what other people's genitals are called, and not in a euphemistic way. We have, unfortunately, dealt with cases where children have disclosed to one of our staff that, you know, somebody has touched their golden flower, and it's impossible for us to accurately identify that they're talking about their vulva or vagina if we don't, you know what they're saying. So if we are changing a baby's nappy, if a toddler is learning to use the toilet, really simply saying, you know, when you go to the toilet, you know, don't forget to wipe your bottom and don't forget to wipe your vulva from front to back.
So you're giving them language around it. It's teaching hygiene, yeah. And this also becomes language that is appropriate if they do need to disclose something.
Without it being scary for them.
So you mentioned songs and books before. On the text line, Mike says, a Melbourne band for kids, Teeny Tiny Stevies, has great messaging in their lyrics. One of their songs, Boss of My Own Body, is an excellent example of body safety. Well, let's actually take a little listen to some of that song.
I'm not the boss of the playground. I'm not the boss of the merry-go-round. But I am the boss of one thing. I'm not the boss of my brothers and sisters. I'm not the boss of the babysitter. But I am the boss of one thing. I'm the boss of my own body. I'm the boss of my own body. Yeah, I can make these...
Deanne, it makes me think it doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful.
I think that this is such a great example of ways that children are learning those messages without, you know, actually connecting it to the fact that somebody may harm them. But then if somebody does or somebody tries to, they have the tools there that they need. So Teeny Tiny Stevie's song is amazing. We also use a great book called Don't Touch My Hair, which is about, you know, a child who's, you know, adults are always touching her hair and she doesn't like it. She wants it to stop. And she's learning how to find her voice and be really assertive in her communication. Go, stop. I don't like it. Don't touch my hair. You have to ask first. So it doesn't even have to be about genitals or anything intimate. It can just be about, you know, understanding that you have rights to make choices.
So we're talking a lot here about kids with words. What about infants? What about kids that aren't speaking yet?
Yeah, obviously it's a lot more difficult for children who are pre-verbal or non-verbal to communicate that something is going on for them. We can still teach them their rights from that earlier stage. One of the things that we teach is image autonomy. So you have the right not only to your own body but to your image. And this is letting them know that they have right to say no to photos and to having videos made of them, because so much of the child sexual abuse that we're seeing nowadays is being filmed and is being shared on the dark web. So it's as simple as saying to a baby, is it okay if I take your photo, or I'm going to send this photo to Nana who's overseas. You can see it here on, you know, the app that I'm using. And, of course, infants don't understand that, but you're setting up you know, a culture where you're asking permission, you're letting them know that they have the right to say no in those spaces. Of course, when it comes to identifying whether a child has been hurt and abused, a lot of the time their behavioural signs. So, you know, children's behaviour suddenly changes. They might become fearful or withdrawn or, or not as engaged with the things that are in the places that they would normally like to be.
Rachel, I'd love to come back to you for a minute because the focus of this conversation has very much been on the negative, because it is. It's mm-hmm. a terrible story. But can we just recap for a second on what kids do get out of early childhood education and care and why we just shouldn't write it off entirely?
Oh, look, absolutely. Good quality childcare has been shown over and over again to improve a whole range of different things, you know, from cognitive capacity, but also importantly, social skills. And that's one of the things that, you know, sometimes perhaps doesn't get as much press as it should, and it's actually really, really important. And sort of good social skills also build in those good understandings of what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, how to ask for help or tell people stuff. So in a weird way, that really good quality childcare experience will sort of bolster all of those skills. And, you know, we have to remind ourselves that over the last, say, 1,500 years, you know, once upon a time, everyone's grandma had six kids. So you were raised in an environment with your peer group, you know, lots of kids of different ages. We just don't have that as a society anymore. So childcare actually brings that in. So those kids can have that real sort of peer-to-peer experience, building friendships, building social skills, and indeed even getting a little bit of an edge on cognitive capacity as well.
Rachel, Deanne, thank you both so much. It's been really practical and reassuring. Dr. Rachel Sharman is a senior lecturer in psychology at the University of the Sunshine Coast, specialising in child and adolescent development. Deanne Carson is the CEO of Body Safety Australia. If this chat's raised issues for you, seek help. Lifeline's available on 13 11 14. And thank you for your text as well. Anthony says, this is early childhood education. Bring all centres into the state education system and apply the same rules and standards. Parents shouldn't have to be the gatekeeper of standards of early childhood education centres. Already, we spend billions of dollars as a nation in childcare. Let's make sure it's done right, even if it means huge change. Well, coming up next here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National, one of the first pioneers of the internet and why he still believes in trust, even in a time of political polarisation and artificial intelligence.
As each day begins,
get the facts you need to stay informed.
Every day, across your day, you can stay in the know with ABC News.
To fuel your daily conversations, follow the discussion to stay connected.
From your neighbourhood, across the country,
and around the world.
Stay with Australia's trusted news source.
All the latest, all verified. Stay in the know with ABC News.
Go to news.abc.net.au or download the ABC News app.
In the early days of the internet, my guest had a thought. What if we could take the kind of information you find in an encyclopedia and put it online, but set things up so that any user could add to that information and at the same time make sure all that new information is verified? I'm pretty sure you've guessed the website by now. It's Wikipedia. And its founder, Jimmy Wales, has written about what he's learned along the way in a new book, The Seven Rules of Trust, why it's today's most essential superpower. Jimmy Wales, welcome.
Great. Thanks for having me on. Good to be here.
Why did you choose trust as the focus of this book?
Well, if you look around the world today, we really do see a crisis of trust as, you know, if you look at the Edelman Trust Barometer survey, which is across many different countries, we've seen a long and steep decline in trust in journalism, trust in politics, trust in institutions. Meanwhile, there's a lot of lessons I've learned from Wikipedia about trust. Wikipedia is very trusting. It lets people come and edit, and it's a very open system, and we're very welcoming. And so I just thought, okay, well, look, let's see if we can share some of what I've learned, and hopefully people find it useful.
So you say Wikipedia is very trusting, and that's built into the way it's set up. It's also very trusted. Is this, I know that reciprocity is one of your rules. Do you think that's where that trust has come from?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different elements. Certainly, you know, that Wikipedia is open to participation, gives people some assurance. It isn't managed top down, and you know, sometimes people who don't realize that assume you know, that the editorial content of Wikipedia is somehow approved by me or something like that, but that isn't really how it works. But you know, there are a lot of other things. The transparency is really, really important. You know, the idea that in order to give people some assurance about the content, we need to have links to our sources, and we need to show the debates, all of that.
I do want to talk about what you say are some of the ways we can restore this trust, but it feels like we can't really talk to you, Jimmy, without talking about Wikipedia, without talking about this thing that you've made. I'd love to go back to the sort of origin story of Wikipedia. There's actually a really personal story about the birth of your daughter that fed into what the site has become.
Yeah, when Kira was born, she was very ill. She had meconium aspiration syndrome. And I had been working and trying to build an encyclopedia for some time and was really on the verge of giving up. I mean, it was very hard, and it wasn't really clear how we were going to do it. And, you know, the doctor who treated Kira was fantastic. He gave me all the kinds of things I needed in order to trust him. Like, he treated me as an equal, and he explained the science to me and all of those good things. And I went and tried to research on the internet the condition. And I mean, it was terrible. There wasn't much out there. It was, you know, some of it was high quality in one sense, but it was academic journal articles, which, as a person who's not a medical specialist, it was really hard to understand. I was like, wow, you know, an encyclopedia, it really is important. We really do need this. And so I came home from the hospital, you know, sort of re-energized to say, we have to try this. And that was when I set up the wiki, which was an idea we had been playing with a little bit, and said, you know what, we have to give it one more try. We have to try this crazy idea, because the end goal seems worth it, to have a free encyclopedia for everybody in their own language. It motivated me and it excites me. And I now have this personal sort of connection to, like, how important it is to have that information you need when you need it.
Can you tell me about what the energy was around the internet at that time?
Well, it was a very exciting time. And, you know, one of the reasons Wikipedia has ended up as a charity, as a nonprofit, was really because when I was starting Wikipedia, I didn't actually have a very clear idea of what any sort of business model was. I mean, we sort of thought, okay, well, maybe we'll put ads on, or maybe we could charge money. It was just an exciting time to say, like, clearly this needs to exist. We'll just start it and we'll figure out the business model later. And so that was kind of the dot-com boom era. And, you know, it was kind of okay to just start a project and just see what you could make and then figure out the details later. But by the time, you know, it started to grow and all this, it became obvious to me, it really felt like it needed to be in a nonprofit structure. You know, we're an educational project run by volunteers. Plus, it was a dot-com crash, and there was no way to raise money or to do anything else. So it all worked, and, you know, thank goodness.
I'm always amazed at the way that Wikipedia is run by volunteers, and I wonder what you've learned from the kind of people who choose that for themselves over the years.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Wikipedia volunteers tend to be very geeky, very, you know, we're a bunch of geeks and we're nerdy and we're really interested in information and knowledge. We tend to be not particularly political people. You know, it's a different personality type from, like, social media influencer types. You know, a lot of people in Wikipedia, there is some social component to it. Obviously, you meet other people and so forth, and there's you get a social reputation for doing good work in the community. But nobody's becoming famous from editing Wikipedia. You know, it's not that's just not what we're all about.
And every couple of years, there's a story that will pop up about you being like, can you believe this guy isn't a billionaire? Like, do you feel like you maybe in retrospect could have set the site up slightly differently?
You know, I mean, the thing is, I just always say, like, look, in, you know, in 100-year time, people are going to look back on Wikipedia and say, you know what, there was a lot of bad stuff going on, but that was actually really good. Like, it wasn't perfect, but a lot of great people came together to give this amazing gift to the world. I'm really proud of that. And I really think that's exciting. And then also, you know, my life is so interesting. You know, I can talk to anybody in the world I want to. And, you know, like, and, you know, sometimes, you know, we need me to speak to prime ministers or presidents or whatever, and they'll take my call. I mean, that's completely crazy. I'm just this geek. I mean, I'm literally sitting in my basement where I work, you know? And, you know, it's just great fun. And you know, so many lovely people, and it's just a wonderful thing to be a part of.
It sounds like such a beautiful, shiny thing. It's so lovely to hear yourself just describe yourself as an optimist and have retained that optimism over 2.5 decades. But I do want to kind of acknowledge the fact that public perceptions of Wikipedia have shifted so much over the years. Mm. It was a bit of a gimmick. It was then seen as sort of a source that uni. Well, this is my experience as a uni student.
Yeah,
we
yeah.
loved it, but our lecturers yeah. were like, no, it's unreliable. Then it had this sort of heyday of neutrality. Now a lot of the criticism is that it's overly woke. How do you grapple with these shifts? It's your baby.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in part there are two ways that we're responding to that. So first, you know, just putting out there to people, like, neutral point of view is still our number one core policy, and we're really, really passionate about that, and the community is very passionate about that. Number two, okay, when we get criticism, the way we've always dealt with criticism is we can't bury our head in the sand. We have to say, okay, like, what? Like, yeah, help us. Like, we want your help. How do we figure that out? Like, where are we making mistakes? What are the things we need to do? I mean, of course, we have to understand right now there's this, you know, enormous culture war going on. And on a lot of topics, people have kind of lost their minds. And so, you know, if you see an anti-vax person saying, oh, they're just putting forth mainstream propaganda, I'm just like, it's called science, actually. And, you know, we do acknowledge the you know, there are legitimate scientific questions around certain vaccines and this, that, and the other. And, you know, that's all legitimate. But broadly, we aren't going to sort of throw aside science and say, yes, but this actress thinks that vaccines are bad. Like, no, that's not how it works. And so, you know, some of that criticism, you know, I don't know what to tell people except, you know, take a deep breath, slow down a little bit, stop listening to randos on the internet and think. And in other cases, I think, okay, well, hold on. Yeah, maybe we could do better. Like, let's take a look at that.
This is personal for you, though. You didn't found Wikipedia on your own. Your co-founder, Larry Sanger, was there at the beginning with you, but more recently has criticized the current state of Wikipedia. I'm really curious to know that what that feels like to have a relationship that I imagine was originally very close, having such a public rift.
You know, it doesn't bother me at all. Like, Larry hasn't been involved for over 20 years, and he has managed to get his voice heard because certain people like Elon Musk are very keen to undermine the facts of reality. And that's unfortunate. And, you know, I think some of Larry's criticisms are interesting. Most of them are really misinformed about how Wikipedia works. And, you know, there we are. But, you know, whatever. It's all part of the dialogue and discourse. I mean, I think what I'm all about is saying, look, we need to stop taking debate so personally, right? If somebody says, oh, hey, there's a problem here, don't get defensive and say, oh, I hate you. Da, da, da. No, just say, oh, hold on a second. Like, I think you're mistaken, or maybe you're right on this part. Like, let's work on that together.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor speaking to Jimmy Wales, Wikipedia co-founder. And thank you for your texts on this chat about basically trust and the future of the internet and society. One person says trust, great topic. Surely it starts with our governments, but each time they increase surveillance, decrypt our electronic communications, and above all, conceal information from us, they undermine the trust that's essential for democracy. People naturally follow, soon we'll have nothing left. LJK in Nam says, thank you so much for the interview with Jimmy Wales. It's about building community. Trust is so important for society and Wikipedia, an important part of that. So, Jimmy, you have described yourself as an optimist. You have this really human approach to the internet, but we have to talk about the non-human elements of the modern internet now. AI has become such a huge feature of our online lives. How concerned are you about what its arrival means for Wikipedia?
Well, I mean, now that you've sort of psychoanalyzed me a little bit, you probably will guess I'm not worried. I'm like interested. Like, that sounds interesting. So we're, you know, obviously there are things we have to be mindful of. I mean, one of the issues that we're all going to face is very low quality AI slop, as people are calling it, sort of low quality content that's misleading, and whether deliberately being weaponized or whether just it's just low quality and that's what it is. At the same time, you know, when we look at this ability to analyze documents in a completely new and humanish kind of way, the ability to generate text, I think there are some opportunities for us at Wikipedia, not to use it to write Wikipedia entries. The hallucination problem is still really bad. And, you know, when we do see it improving to some extent, but, you know, like when ChatGPT-5 was being touted just before it came out, as if the problem had been solved. And then it came out and everybody's like, well, no, it's still a bit bonkers, you know, like it still gets a lot wrong, particularly on more obscure topics. At the same time, like, you know, it's pretty good at summarizing text. It's so, you know, like I wrote a little script just being a geek, you know, you can feed it a short entry and the five sources, if there's five sources, say, and ask it, are there any facts in the sources that should be in Wikipedia but aren't? Or is there anything in Wikipedia that's not supported by the sources? Give me some suggestions. And it's pretty good. It's not perfect. It doesn't get it all right. And sometimes it makes a suggestion and you're like, that doesn't really fit our style or framework. But other times it's like, oh, okay, like that could be a useful tool to support the work of humans. You know, when we think about things like bias in Wikipedia, well, one of the things, we have a lot of great volunteers who are like, okay, I want to help work on that. Feed me some articles where there are some problems potentially with bias, and maybe the AI could scan over all of Wikipedia and say, oh, this article seems to really take one side of this issue. And, you know, having read the sources and all that, and maybe it'll be wrong sometimes. And you're like, no, it's not really. And other times it might be, oh, okay, right. Actually, here's an article I can work on. And so I'm excited about that possibility of, you know, figuring out ways to leverage the technology to support our very, very human community.
Would you ever see a situation where Wikipedia would work with an AI company to use Wikipedia content for training?
Well, they do already. I mean, all the major AIs are heavily trained on Wikipedia. It's all freely licensed, so everybody can take the content and do what they like. We are trying to encourage these companies to stop hammering our servers by crawling us so heavily all the time, and instead, you know, pay us for a feed. Like, that's actually, you know, would be very helpful. And, you know, we're getting response. Google's a great customer for that. You know, they recognize it's a better product for them. And it's like not nice to just hammer our servers without paying us some money. So that's all working very well. And, you know, in general, I think we're very interested in what's going on in the open source world as well. So it isn't just these big companies. We're interested in, you know, models that are being released under free licenses and, you know, how the open source community is starting to do some really innovative work around inferencing and training and so forth. So, yeah, it's an exciting time. And I'm, you know, personally, I'm quite obsessed with it all.
You talked before about that sort of optimism of the early internet, and you write in your book that those early days felt like, it really felt like the internet could change the world in a good way. Do you think that there's mm-hmm. a way we could get back to that optimism as a society?
Yeah, I mean, I do, and I think these things tend to go in you know, it's a pendulum swing, and lately we've been in a bit of a negative mode. I talk about how, you know, when it was in the U.S., when it was Obama versus McCain, I was, like, really proud of the U.S. I was like, you know what, I have agreements and disagreements with each of them, but they're both proper people, they're both sensible, you know, they're both willing to work together with politicians who they disagree with and so on and so forth. That's functional politics. Like, that's actually great. Since then, not so much, right? And since then, obviously, things have deteriorated. But that will pass. We'll get better leaders at some point. And, you know, yeah.
Just coming back to the book, the process of writing a book can be really illuminating because you're sort of forced to articulate your point of view and reflect on what's happened to you. What has your book writing process helped you with in your own understanding of your own story?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the book is the Seven Rules of Trust, and that putting the concept of trust, which I always felt was, you know, important. I mean, I did know that. But really articulating it made me really understand how much it underlies a huge amount of things in society, you know, and we, the way we live day to day, we actually do trust other people. Like, it's a good bet. Like, it's not pie in the sky. It's like, oh, why do we trust other people? Because generally they're trustworthy. And this is how society functions. If we were as horrible as social media makes us seem sometimes, we would have gone extinct a long, long time ago. But people, you know, they do cooperate, and people are mainly reliable, and they look after each other, and they live up to their word and all that good stuff. And I hadn't really ever stopped to pause to really reflect on how important all that is, how important it is that businesses be trustworthy, that we treat other people as in with respect and say, like, oh, I said I would do the thing, so I better do the thing, you know, like, that's really important. And so the process of writing the book was really all about kind of making that more clear to myself and then hopefully clear to the reader.
The book is called The Seven Rules of Trust. But if you had to pick one rule that you hoped that people really kind of took away from it, what is it?
I think it's the rule is purpose. The idea that you really need to have and to have a very clear purpose. This particularly applies to organizations and so forth. So for Wikipedia, our purpose is a high quality, neutral encyclopedia. And it really clarifies everything else that we do. And it keeps us from getting distracted with, I don't know, if people say, oh, why don't you do this or do that? And it's like, that's not really an encyclopedia. Let's just keep focused on what we're good at and do that. And I just think that one is really important. And tying purpose to trust is what I think might be a little surprising. It's like, because we have purpose, you can predict what we're going to do. You know, Wikipedia isn't going to sort of cave into censorship in China and start editing Wikipedia to please the Chinese government, because that's not consistent with a high quality encyclopedia. And so that kind of principled approach to life can help other people to trust you and understand where you're coming from.
Jimmy, thank you so much for making time for me today.
Yeah, lovely. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, it's great.
Jimmy Wales is a co-founder of Wikipedia, the author of The Seven Rules of Trust, Why It Is Today's Most Essential Superpower, and a lot of love for you, Jimmy, on the text line. Lynn says, how refreshing to hear Jimmy Wales, a person with values that matter, not blinded by money and genuinely interested in meaningful progress through respectful dialogue with other humans. Need more like him. Another says, wonderful to, inverted commas, meet Jimmy Wales. I hadn't thought about who created Wikipedia. I've used it to create or enhance knowledge of Australian artists who had little documentation. It's terrific. Well, up next here on ABC Radio National's Life Matters, about a decade or so ago, millions of Facebook users around the world were caught up in a massive data breach, and you may be eligible for compensation.
Ever since Beef Wellington became a murder weapon, I've been wondering, what's up with mushrooms? Hello, Anne Jones here from What the Duck, and I'm trying to work out why would fungi be so poisonous that it can kill you? And death caps in particular, why are you so apparently delicious? What do you want, to be eaten or not? To find out, search for What the Duck and look for mushrooms. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Did you have a Facebook account around 2013? I know it's hard to think that far back. That was the year we had three different prime ministers, several years before a billionaire reality star became the US president. And yeah, there was that pandemic in the mix as well. But trust me, it's worth doing this particular maths, because if you did, you may be eligible for compensation from its parent company, Meta, as part of a landmark $50 million privacy breach payout here in Australia. The payments stem from Facebook's involvement in the Cambridge Analytica scandal, a massive data breach in the 2010s. You might remember back in 2018, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg testified before US Congress and offered a personal apology for the breach of private data. You are about to hear who's likely to get compensation. I will spoil this a little bit for you. It's not going to be very much. With me is Dr. Catherine Kemp, Associate Professor at the Faculty of Law and Justice, the University of New South Wales. Catherine, can you give me a bit of a background on this legal case? Because it's sort of been on the boil for a decade or so now.
Yeah, you're right. And I think a lot of people will have heard about the Cambridge Analytica scandal and vaguely remember what it's about. But to remind us, the revelation happened back in 2018 when it was discovered that there was this political consulting firm, Cambridge Analytica, that had managed to get hold of tens of millions of Facebook users' personal information. And they'd done that via a researcher who had used the sharing arrangements that Facebook put in place for its data for third-party developers to extract information from users. Now, the way he did this was to offer users an app called This Is Your Digital Life, which essentially allowed them to take a quiz about themselves, you know, these quizzes online that will sort of spit out a score or a result about what you are like. And people somehow get fascinated about that. And
look, I'm not going to judge. I love that sort of stuff.
That's quite a revelation in itself. But it was actually, you know, in Australia, for example, it was only 53 people who downloaded that app. But the one of the security breaches that occurred here was that Facebook's interface at the time for those third-party developers allowed them to access not only the information of the person using the app, but also all of their friends on Facebook. And obviously that meant that those people had no idea that their information about their profiles and so forth was being fed through to this political consulting firm that used that for psychological profiling of people to then target political ads to them. And funny you should mention the billionaire reality star who became president, because it's been reported that that information was used in his political campaign for his election as president the first time round through the services of Cambridge Analytica.
The crazy thing about this is the numbers, right? I think the investigation found only 53 Australian Facebook users installed the app, but that scaled up to hundreds of thousands of people once the friends thing was folded in. How is it even possible for that information to be shared without consent?
Well, that was the problem with what we called the API that Facebook had in place at that time, the application programming interface, that these developers were allowed to use the consent of the user that they were immediately interacting with to essentially get consent of all of their friends. Now, we know that's a complete fiction, and it is clearly highly problematic in terms of data security and a breach of privacy. But that is what allowed that access to estimated 87 million Facebook users' information.
Tell me about this compensation claim then in Australia.
So in Australia, our privacy commissioner was bringing proceedings against Meta, Facebook's parent company, in respect of this data breach. That what they decided late last year was that they would instead accept an enforceable undertaking from Meta, and that as part of this, Meta would set up a $50 million fund for the Facebook payment program, as it's called. So users who were Facebook users from that late 2013 through to late 2015 period could apply for compensation if they were in Australia for more than 30 days at the time, or and in addition to that, they'd actually downloaded this is your digital life app themselves, or one of their friends had. And then this allowed them to avoid a final decision by the court and going through all of that litigation in exchange for saying we will pay some compensation.
$50 million sounds like a lot of money, but when you break it down over the numbers we're talking about, it's not really very much.
That's right. It is conceivable that people would end up maybe with $100 each, or you know, maybe a couple of hundred if they're lucky. In the US, where a similar fund was set up, each user ultimately got, on average, about US$35. So people shouldn't be getting too excited about the potential of retiring on this kind of compensation.
Maybe a lunch at a mid-scale restaurant, perhaps.
If you're lucky.
What sort of lessons should we be taking from this? This is sort of a particular legal case. Sure, maybe you get $30, maybe you don't. But there are kind of implications of how we navigate the internet from this.
There are. I think, you know, as we were saying before, part of this came through people downloading this app or taking this survey, this questionnaire. Now, that's a really common thing online, and a lot of people will think, oh, this will be cute, this will be interesting, I'll share the result with my friends on social media. But of course, these things aren't free. There's no free lunch. If they're offering to ask you all of these questions to spit out a score about you, then they're also taking that information and selling it to data brokers and attaching it to a profile about you, because this is one of the many ways in which data brokers build that 360-degree profile on you, which in this case might be connected to you because of device fingerprinting or because it's attached to your Facebook user information. It's also, I think, an indication of how concealed, how invisible a lot of these data practices are, and that people are placing their trust in these digital platforms that they deal with, but they can't see what's happening. And if we're lucky, we find out years later in some cases what was going on, but there are many of those concealed data practices that we never become aware of. And I think the last thing I would say we should learn is that this is a big example of why privacy is not just about us as individuals and our personal choices. It demonstrates really clearly why, as a country, we have a public interest in privacy, because it affects those decisions, affect a broad array and a network of people, but also it affects the outcomes, for instance, of elections. It affects things like expression of racial hatred, of the perpetration and dissemination of violent material. And that affects the whole of our society.
Catherine, thank you so much for sharing this information with us today. Dr. Catherine Kemp is an associate professor at the Faculty of Law and Justice at the University of New South Wales. I will say one of the things that goes alongside the fact that we are talking about this on the radio and that there's a lot of publicity around this is that there are scams around this as well. So take care if you think you might be one of those people who are eligible. There are scams around this as well, but you do have until the 31st of December 2025 to make your claim. facebookpaymentprogram.com.au/FAQ is the website you can go to for more information. Thank you so much for your text. We spoke earlier in the show about the early childhood education and care sector and the really horrible revelations that have come out of Four Corners about pedophiles exploiting loopholes in the system to get access to children, and just what it means to be a parent when that is the state of play. You've been texting me about this. Tess says, I'm co-director of Kids Body Safety. I've written an award-winning book, Everyone's Got a Bottom. This gives parents and teachers a resource to talk to children about body knowledge and body safety. Another text says, I've worked in the early learning sector for almost 2 decades and I feel like I have been screaming into the abyss. Even as an 18-year-old, I could see the deficiencies of this systemic structure being for profit. I've been appealing to the government and media for over a decade about the inadequacies of the sector and the enormous risks we are exposing children to. That is almost it for Life Matters today, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow on the show, I'll be joined by Shane Janek, who you may know better as Courtney Act. Shane's written a book and will be joining me to talk about the art that helped you accept who you are. Plus, why we are obsessed with tracking our sleep and whether it's doing us any good. And Instagram is turning 15, which I guess means it's nearly old enough to have an account on its own platform. And it's shaped our lives in more ways than you might think. I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.